Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on this Monday edition on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Coming up on today's program, we'll look at a few headlines. Also, thetrumpet.com, top story there. It's got a new look, by the way, thetrumpet.com. We'll talk about that. Also, a preview of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show that's coming up later today. Very interesting historical note, and a look at a book, Character in Crisis. There is a crisis of character in the United States. We'll take a look at that and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live at 101.3 KPCG and online. We're at kpcg.fm. Have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And thetrumpet.com is a new look, trumpet.com. Dwight Falk and Grant Turgeon with you here today. You've no doubt seen the new look, trumpet.com.
Yeah, just this morning. I was really impressed by that.
Yeah, it looks great. It looks great. So we'll talk about that a little bit more, I guess, as we go on with the program here. But same great content, but a updated package, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that has to happen from time to time, and except unless you're Drudge Report. I don't think they've ever changed
their
look.
They're stuck in the early 90s.
It works for them. So, but anyway, it's a new updated trumpet, thetrumpet.com. I got to make sure I say the so we don't get confused there. Thetrumpet.com. And a really great looking website now, updated and improved. So make sure you check that out when you get a chance. Lots to talk about today, including some headlines. The news of the day is this from the Washington Post. Manafort, former business partner indicted on money laundering tax charges in connection with special counsel probe. This is the special counsel probe into collusion, I guess, between the United States and Russia. And these are the charges that were brought forward today. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort and his longtime business partner Rick Gates have been charged in a 12-count indictment with conspiracy to launder money, making false statements, and other charges stemming from probes into possible Russian influence in the U.S. political affairs. So the 12 counts there, and we'll see what comes of that. And I don't know if there's more coming down the line or not, but I read a comment about the story where this person said, well, it seems like there should be a lot more Democrats saying something about this. And maybe there are, I don't know. But I also thought, I don't know if as a politician they'd be too eager to get up and say anything, because chances are there's a lot of fingers in the pie there. And you know, I don't know that anybody wants a special counsel just checking out every business dealing and transaction they've had over the last how many ever years.
And we saw even maybe a glimpse of that with the Russian dossier and how the Democratic Party was able to pay for some research that came from Russia against the president. And a lot of it was just slanderous and it pretty much all lies. But then they tried to explain it by saying, you know, this is just what you do in a campaign. You try to dig up information to smear your opponent. So it seems like everyone is paying for information, or they're paying for influence of some sort. You can't really accuse too strongly the other side when it does appear that the Democrats may be as involved with Russia, if not actually much more.
It seems like everything that gets looked at a little more closely, whether it's politics or Hollywood now, what's going on there, the closer you look, the worse it gets. And there's a lot of people in the mix. So just an interesting situation. So we'll see what comes of it. I'm sure there'll be some really good updates at thetrumpet.com as more information comes out. But that's the latest on that situation. Over the weekend, the NFL protests, of course, continued, I guess. I didn't pay much attention. I watched a little bit of football, but I didn't bother seeing any of the protest stuff. But apparently it still happened. And I guess it's the eighth week now that this has been going on. I did see a headline that the Texans football team, that most of them kneeled, mm-hmm. or something in response to their owner saying something about the you can't let the convicts run the prison or something,
right.
like that.
Yeah.
And, of course, they took it personally. That's a very common expression. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're saying people are convicts, but I think they took it that way.
That story really irritated me because – it just takes like the slightest level of reading and comprehension skills to understand. If he's calling you all inmates, then he's calling himself the prison. Clearly, he's not meaning for that phrase to be taken literally. The owner of the team doesn't want to be considered a prison, right? So, of course, he's not expecting people to be comparing his analogy to slavery or to criminals or anything like that. It's just surprising that nearly the entire team kneeled just because of those comments. He was only bringing out the point that the vast majority of NFL fans don't like to see these political statements made at games, so you can't have the minority or the inmates running the prison. That's what he said. It clearly wasn't a reference to anything like he has been accused of. It's just so unfair that people take one phrase or one analogy and apparently that's all it takes to kneel for the anthem. Apparently, some of these people have so little respect for the country that if they weren't kneeling already, that is all it took. Him saying that was all it took to disrespect the entire country.
Yeah, and even that protest, it makes no sense. If you're going to protest the owner, wouldn't you just not play or something?
Yeah.
Like, what does it have to do with the net? See, everything now gets mixed up into this weird protesting. There's a write-up today saying that, and it's speculation, of course, but they're saying ESPN may possibly abandon NFL football. They pay a lot for the rights to the games, and so I mean people aren't watching like they used to, so you know that's going to be the real wake-up call for everybody, is if people just stop paying the big money, and then there go your big contracts, and then okay, what are you going to do if you're a player? Or if it's a big industry, players, announcers, owners, everybody. And if you bite the hand that feeds too much, then you got to find a new hand.
Yeah, good point. It, obviously, they are not showing too much respect for their owner. I mean, in any job, you have to do what the owner or the boss says. These players are so hypersensitive that they have to, I guess, fight back at any sort of orders or any sort of any statement that rings of them being told what to do. They fight back against it every time. Although, if they were getting fined for it, if they were getting suspended for it, if the owner did some of the things that he's allowed to do, I'm sure they would not be protesting for very long. That's the irony of it. They think they're protesting injustice and that they're such courageous warriors for justice, and yet they would stop very quickly if the owner exercised the authority that he is certainly allowed to.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The funny thing, too, about football is that you go into the huddle and you're told what play to run.
Yeah. Should they rebel against that, too?
Yeah. I mean, you got to follow directions at some point or you're going to have some problems. But anyway, so that's an ongoing thing there over the weekend in the U.S. Here's a headline that is probably not that surprising. U.S. savings rate crashes to 10-year lows as spending surges, most since Cash for Clunkers. You might remember that Cash for Clunkers program. You could trade in your old car. They call them clunkers. Maybe it was a good car, but you trade in your old gas guzzler, as it were, and then you could you know, buy a new one, and they'd give you some money there to help you out. But anyway, the U.S. savings rate crashes to 10-year lows. So we're getting back to really high debt levels, low savings levels. It changed just a touch after 2008, the Great Recession. And now people are going back and to kind of the old ways and the old habits. And I saw a story last week that, of course, the holiday shopping season is coming up, and there's great consumer confidence. So there's spend. But a lot of that's debt spending.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem like a lot of people, they know they can fall back on the credit card if there's some sort of an emergency that they have to pay for. But I'm sure most credit cards do have a limit. And so if people already have close to $10,000 in credit card debt, which I believe is about the average, the credit card companies are not just going to let you put another $10,000 or $20,000 of debt. If you're proving that you're not paying it already, you can't just put more and more debt on there and expect to be bailed out every single time. It's just a very precarious way to live life, to think that someone else and their company is going to keep on paying for you despite the fact that you have shown you won't be paying it back.
It's a vicious cycle because the retailers rely on the buying and the buyers rely on the credit, and it just kind of keeps going and going. I think the stats are $16,000 on average.
Oh, wow.
That might be per family as opposed to individual, but I think those are the numbers. So that's a fair bit of debt. So anyway, that the savings are lower and the spending is higher. So we'll see how that goes. It doesn't end well. That never ends well.
No.
You never read a story or a history about somebody that didn't save and spend everything they had, and it just worked out great in the end.
Yeah.
I can't think of one instance.
No, and that doesn't even take into account the strain that it puts on marriages and families when you know you just always have this debt hanging over your head. And even when there's not debt, like personally, when I don't feel like I've been putting enough money in savings recently, I feel bad about that, much less having, you know, over $10,000 of debt, which I don't. I'm thankful for that. But it just seems like you would always be having disputes over the finances when, you know, the bills come around. You can't pay them because you have such a huge debt already. Just a huge, hugely stressful, burdensome way to be living life.
Yeah, for sure. There's some great write-ups at thetrumpet.com, some great booklets about finances and so forth. And, of course, you can find financial help books all over the place, but these are really good biblically-based advice. You know, no matter what situation you're in, if you're in a little debt or whatever the case may be, great information there at thetrumpet.com, so check that out. Speaking of thetrumpet.com, it is a new look, trumpet.com. I like the blog on the side now. The columnists, and I like the drawings, the sketches of the authors. They're very accurate too. In case you're wanting, in case you haven't seen these writers in person, you don't know who they are. Visually, they're very accurate.
Well, that's the art department earning its money, isn't it? Those are some fantastic sketches.
Mm-hmm.
You just see a lot of skill that went into those.
Yeah, they look great. They look very accurate. So anyway, check out the trumpet.com. That's not the biggest update, but I thought it was cool.
I think people have always responded well to having that little column on the side.
Uh-huh.
With the columnists, or I guess they call it the blogs now. So people like to have personalities on the website that they can follow.
Yeah, and there's really good, I mean, and of course those trumpet briefs come out just about every day, Monday through Friday, and always great information in there. And you can read through them, you know, in 10, 15 minutes, but really get a good insight into what's going on in the world, what's important, because there's so many headlines and they're just not that important in most cases, but you can get the important ones there at thetrumpet.com. New look, check out the website. Top story today is the election that shook Germany. Again, compliments to the art department that they have the cover there from the latest Trumpet. Mm-hmm. It looks great. Germany splitting in half sort of there by the Reichstag.
Wow.
And the flag and everything. So it's a great illustration of what's happening there, and things are really changing in the German landscape. This write-up is from Brad McDonald, and it said voters handed the political establishment a beating. The nation may not have a government for months. They have to try to form their coalitions. When it comes, it will be divided and weak. Germany's recent election portends greater crisis to come. So check that out. They need a new leader. Related to that, wanted a leader for Europe and a turning point in German politics. So make sure you check that out. Can you imagine if they had some major attack or something happened to them? Of course, no one knows what will happen there for sure, but they've had their terror problems, and here they have this sort of fractured government trying to figure out coalitions. Any sort of problem would really be exacerbated.
And that's why you see the prophecy about the strong man, because when they have crises like that, and especially in a situation like right now where the government is so divided, or at least it's weak, you can't really respond quickly to those types of situations. You can't pursue and find these criminals who are obviously carrying out these gigantic attacks. It's not just the one terrorist. It's always a cell of people who are supporting that man and making sure that the attack is carried out successfully. You have to be able to have a government in charge of the security forces and in charge of these other areas of the government, or else you're just in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, they need a national game plan to deal with things that people can get behind and support, and I don't know what it is currently. I think Angela Merkel said basically, you know, they're just going to be the moral voice, I guess, of Europe, which would mean letting a lot of people in. But then if you look at some of the recent elections, I think it was in Austria, where that younger guy won in his early 30s, 31, I think. And part of his success was because he had a good plan for keeping the immigrants out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where he got some of his clout from. So that's I guess the sentiment on the ground, which you can understand. They don't want, Europe doesn't want more migrants pouring in, especially when they're causing problems. And so you've got the old guard there with Angela Merkel, you know, still trying to do the old policies, but nobody wants them anymore.
Yeah, actually, I saw, I think it was a German newspaper that a couple of times called that Austrian leader Hitler because of, I guess, some of those types of policies. So you see the liberal media exaggerating to the extremes once again, and that doesn't fit with the mindset of the everyday German. They don't see the migrants and then just think, oh, I'm so happy that our town has been overwhelmed by migrants and we can no longer even use our basic services. They understand that jobs are being taken, that they're, even a lot of their safety and security is being snatched away. And they're voting for leaders who will actually do something about it instead of, you know, casually calling the Austrian leader Hitler.
Yeah, it's interesting. I saw recently a little roundtable discussion. It was about sports, but it relates to this topic. And they were talking to owners of NBA teams and just talking about like their philosophies and how they run their the teams and things. And they said in most cases, nowadays you really have to listen to the fans and kind of try to, not that you have to do everything they say, but you have to make sure that you're paying attention to the trends, the way the public feels. And it used to be that people would say, well, just who cares what they say? We're going to kind of bunker down here in our little hole, and we're going to do what we want. And you can see that even politically over there. The people that are winning are listening to the public sentiment. The people that are kind of losing now, are they're the old guard, where they want to do it their way, even though people don't feel the same as they do.
Exactly. And it is astounding after a while to just see the political establishment here, over there, in so many different places right now, just continually being deaf to the cries of the public. I mean, you would think at some point they would start reconsidering some of their ideas if enough people are crying out that it is adversely affecting them.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens. Anyway, check out that top story at thetrumpet.com, the election that shook Germany. A lot of great write-ups there related to that. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. Make sure you listen for that with your host, Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. It's always live Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. I think they're in they're out of daylight savings over there now, a week ahead of us. So they had to adjust for us. They're doing it an hour earlier, same time here, always 7 o'clock. And then we go back to normal time next this weekend, is that right?
Yeah, it's really soon. So
somewhere in there,
we'll be feeling like it is actually 6 o'clock, right? When it's 7 o'clock,
right?
But it'll finally be bright outside in the morning. It right now it's like 7:45, and you're just starting to see a little bit of sunlight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's it feels like Seattle when you wake up.
Yeah,
because it's always dark and cloudy there. Not always, but often. But so anyway, 7 o'clock here. You can always 7 Central Time. You can get the Trumpet Daily Radio Show replays then throughout the day. And archives at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. And today, a few topics, one of them talking with actually Richard Palmer there for a bit about the new look at thetrumpet.com. Pretty interesting. Get some of the insight into what was going on there with the redesign. And then also just a really bizarre news story he talked about a fair bit in the UK, just how they're really pressuring the health services over there, really pressuring teenagers, very young people, to push forward with this gender transformation, I guess you'd call it. Pretty much anybody that comes in and says, hey, I think I'd like to be a different gender, no questions asked, you better just do it. And it's just outrageous. You have to hear the story. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I would expect that they're probably not even telling their parents. A lot of the time when you hear stories like that, the worst part of it is that they're able to keep it a secret. For example, a young teenage girl's getting abortions, they are allowed to go to these clinics and make that happen without their parents even having any knowledge of it. It's almost like they're turning to the teens and appealing to how smart they are, and they're able to make these massive decisions that will change the rest of their lives without the input of their parents, who have always been looking out for them and trying to guide them the right way. So it is just completely lawless and backward for these institutions to be doing things like that.
Yeah, it's a multifaceted problem. Obviously, the whole gender thing, that's its whole other issue. But just even the fact that they're taking away the authority of the parents, mm-hmm. where you can have young people go out and make decisions, life-altering decisions. I mean, it'll affect them the rest of their lives. And I don't think the parents have much of a say. Certainly, even the officials there, they don't have any say. They say, okay, go ahead. And there are so many decisions in life that are much, much smaller, you know, basic things that you don't let people decide. People don't just walk in, you know, teenagers don't just walk into the mall and say, give me the merchandise. And I'm that doesn't work. Doesn't work that way.
No.
You know, give me a house. Give me a mortgage. You can't do those things. But when it comes to something much more serious, they're not only, you know, allowing it, they're actually encouraging them. They're pressuring them to do these things. They say, hey, look. You know, if you're unhappy in your life or you feel like something's not going right, well, maybe you should change your gender.
Yeah, as if that's just, you know, as casual and easy as changing what you're wearing that day. I mean, it is, that's how they're treating it. And when parents do try to exert any authority like they should be able to in their own families, they get prosecuted for it. They get thrown in prison for trying to say, no, you are a boy. You're born a boy. You're going to stay a boy. People are actually getting in trouble for doing that. That shouldn't be a controversial thing for a parent to do. I mean, if we all put ourselves in the shoes of those parents, we would probably do the same thing. We would definitely want our children to understand their gender and their roles in life and to try to help them be happy as they are instead of fundamentally changing them, especially when you look at the stats. I mean, transgender people commit suicide over 40% of the time. That is monumentally higher. I think it's like 3% among the general public, but over 40% among transgender people. As a parent, you don't want the likelihood of your child killing himself or herself to be way higher. It just makes no sense in any way.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. So you can listen for that story there at the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And, of course, he's highlighting the fact that there's such a moral slide here in the UK and the US, and we're going to talk about that a little bit with a book towards the end of the show here. One historical note that's very interesting on this day, really a terrible event, 1961, the Soviet Union tests a 58 megaton hydrogen bomb named Tsar Bomba. It's kind of a funny name. The most powerful nuclear weapon ever detonated to this point. Massive. The Tsar Bomba mushroom cloud could be seen from a distance of 100 miles, and the crown of the cloud was 56 kilometers or 35 miles high at the time of the picture. You can find the picture online if you search for Tsar Bomba. Still to this day, the most powerful nuclear weapon ever detonated in 1961.
And that gives you chills just hearing about that and imagining how much more we could do now, you know, almost 60 years later. So it's something to consider, especially when we see belligerent nations that have these capabilities and any time could launch one off. And even the Bible says that will happen.
I think the new one that they're trying to get going here, the Satan 2, I believe. I think that one's even bigger from what I've read about it. But this still to this day is the biggest one ever. Exploded, and it was done on this day in 1961. We've got some audio from it, a little documentary that was put together by the History Channel, about 7 minutes long, but it's pretty interesting. It's on this Tsar Bomba detonated on October 30th, 1961, and I'll go ahead and play that for you now.
On a cloudy fall day, a Soviet Tu-95 bomber flies over the island Novaya Zemlya, located in the Arctic Sea. Reaching a height of 35,000 feet, the pilot drops his ordnance. The Tsar Bomba, a 50-megaton nuclear bomb. Within moments, the fusion device detonates, shooting a flash of light through the atmosphere, visible from 600 miles away. It was, and remains, the largest nuclear detonation in history.
Was originally designed to be 100 megatons. It very nearly killed the senior officer who was piloting the aircraft that dropped the test article.
Capable of destroying everything within a 15-mile radius and delivering third-degree burns within a 64-mile radius, the Tsar Bomba remains the final word in total annihilation of an enemy target. Today, the Tsar Bomba is but a reminder of the Cold War arms race and the danger of an all-out nuclear war that would have likely caused the destruction of both the U.S. and Soviet Union, if not the world. Yet the threat of nuclear attack from our former adversary remains.
The risk of accidental attack is more serious, I think, than most people realize. The Russians maintain a large nuclear arsenal. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, they've had a huge economic setback. Their warning system has deteriorated terribly. There are gaps in their radars. Their satellites have broken down. The Russians, of course, reassure us that, no, we have nothing to worry about. But the consequences would be so grave that we should take it very, very seriously, even if it has a minuscule chance of happening at all.
The threat of a nuclear attack from a rogue nation or a well-organized stateless group is also cause for grave concern.
Whether North Korea has nuclear weapons isn't very much in the press today. But should terrorists get their hands on sufficient nuclear materials, either to make a non-nuclear weapon, a radiological weapon, or to actually get a nuclear detonation, however small, would be a horrendous attack.
The evolution of precision guidance systems has eliminated the need for large-yield nuclear weapons like the Tsar Bomba. But make no mistake, the detonation of a 1 megaton nuclear bomb would yield more destructive power than any weapon the world has ever seen.
Weapon, thermonuclear warhead. Yield 1 megaton surface blast. Energy released. Blast, 50%. Thermal radiation, 40%. Fallout, 10%.
To comprehend the true lethality of a thermonuclear explosion requires an understanding of the massive amount of energy that's released upon detonation. When a thermonuclear bomb detonates, an instantaneous fission reaction creates a secondary fusion reaction, fusing hydrogen and its isotopes together to form helium, releasing enormous amounts of energy.
And it occurs in a very small volume. Therefore, the total energy divided by the volume is very large. And that means the temperatures are stupendously high. Temperatures that are higher than the center of the sun.
Upon detonation, a thermonuclear bomb emits a stream of X-rays, infrared rays, and gamma rays. This is referred to as thermal radiation and is visible to the naked eye in the form of a brilliant flash of light lasting from 1 to 10 seconds.
It emits all of this X radiation that's absorbed by the air around it. The outside of the air is burning. It's forming basically smog. The nitrogen and the oxygen are reacting, turns brown, and so the light coming in actually goes down until that burns off, and then it goes up again.
The heat from the infrared rays will set people and buildings on fire. The X-rays will irradiate those closest to the explosion.
The X-rays don't get very far. They're absorbed by the air. The air is then heated up by these X-rays to millions of degrees.
The immense heat expands the air around the point of impact, creating a spherical shockwave and winds that can reach hundreds of miles per hour.
And if it were a humid day, you would be able to see that shockwave running along the ground and through the air because it would cause instant condensation of moisture in the atmosphere, and you'd see sort of a white ghost of a shockwave traveling through the air.
The wind from the shockwave extinguishes the fires caused by the thermal radiation, but will flatten everything in its path within a radius of 2 miles.
You get the expansion out, but then the thermal plume of the bomb is rising. A mushroom cloud is forming. And so you'll get a counterflow, which when air flows up, it sucks things in. And so you get a reversal of the flow as things flow back toward the detonation center and rise.
A 1 megaton surface explosion will lift tons of soil up into the mushroom cloud, which will become irradiated and return as fallout. The heaviest fallout particles will rain down closest to ground zero. People exposed to this fallout will die in a matter of hours from acute radiation sickness. The smaller particles may travel thousands of miles, depending on wind velocity.
If you ingest the material and it stays in your body, the long-term impact is that it can produce significant excess cancer of various sorts.
The combination of thermal radiation, shockwave, and fallout could potentially kill millions, making the thermonuclear bomb easily the world's deadliest weapon. By 2004, the nuclear fraternity consisted of seven countries that had all detonated nuclear devices. Other countries were desperately working toward joining the family. Thus, there appears to be no end in sight to nuclear proliferation, and no end to the threat of attack from the world's deadliest weapon. According to the Center for Defense Information, there are approximately 30,000 intact nuclear warheads worldwide. All but 200 are retained by the United States and Russia. Deadliest weapons will return on Modern Marvels.
So that was some audio, pretty interesting, I thought, from the History Channel there. They were talking about this test that happened on this day in 1961, the Soviet Union tests a 58-megaton hydrogen bomb named Tsar Bomba, the most powerful nuclear weapon ever detonated to this point. But again, there's other weapons out there, and boy, and there's a lot of them. Like they said at the end of that piece, there's, you know, hundreds of them, about 200 or so, but or maybe more than that even. But and they don't know where they all are exactly. So anyway, that's the times we live in. And then you got nations like North Korea and others getting involved. Russia shooting off, of course, more missiles even last week, ballistic missiles. I think Iran came out and said, "Yeah, we're going to keep making ballistic missiles." So just so you know, that's the world we live in. But boy, the damage that would be done from a weapon like that, like they pointed out here for that Tsar Bomba, the mushroom cloud, you could see it from 100 miles away.
Wow.
You know, that's like, let's see, where from where we are, that'd be, well, there's not a lot of towns around here.
It'd be past Tulsa.
Yeah, that's right.
Farther than that.
Past Tulsa, you'd see it. That's amazing. And then it was 35 miles high. So, wow, can imagine something like that, the destruction it would cause. But that was on this day, October 30th in 1961, the largest weapon there ever detonated to this point. So, But Russia keeps working on their weapons. You know, you don't hear a lot about Europe and the weapons they have, but they have quite a few as well.
And they have a lot of American ones. We've talked about that a lot on thetrumpet.com, just how we have trusted a lot of different European nations to hold our weapons, and yet they have the ability to even use them if they want to at some point. And prophecy even states that we will be betrayed by Germany. They have our weapons. Our own weapons could be used against us.
Yeah, irony of ironies. So as much as, I guess, lots of people want peace and they want to demilitarize, good luck convincing Russia and all these other nations. Japan even now getting in the mix. We talked about that on Friday. So there's a lot happening out there, and it's interesting just to look at some of that history. It is really amazing that we haven't had those weapons be used yet. Mm-hmm. But just because they haven't been used yet outside of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, doesn't mean that they won't be. And so that's not something anybody likes to think about, but that's the reality that's out there. We've never made a weapon that we haven't used.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, even recently we dropped that Moab, the mother of all bombs. Where was that, in Syria, or was that...
I want to say Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, yeah. And people were even upset that that was used, even though it was about as justified of a bombing as you could ever have. But, of course, historically, there is a lot of sensitivity to things like that, and it has caused a lot of loss of life. And we're going to see that even more in the future. Dropping the Moab won't seem like anything at all.
Yeah, so more and more of those weapons being proliferated out there. And, of course, you've got the terrorist element, too, so a lot to think about there. And like you mentioned, a lot of good Key David programs and other write-ups there at thetrumpet.com that deal with these topics. We want to talk today a little bit about this booklet, Character in Crisis, written a few years back, but it's always really interesting because the trend has continued to where we're even further into a lack of character in the U.S. and in the West, as was highlighted on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. And this booklet talks about the founding fathers of the United States. Not a popular subject today, by the way. People not very interested in the founding fathers. But to them, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. And as this booklet points out, where did they get that idea from? What does it mean if we have strayed from that ideal today? And they really set out to make a nation that was for the people, ruled by the people, but under God. The Europeans didn't think it could work. They believed it could only end in anarchy and eventual ruin. The question is posed, were the Europeans right? looks more and more that way. But it's because we've gotten away from the under God part. Two pillars that America was founded on, whether people like it or not, religion and morality. Those were the two pillars, but those things have major cracks today if they have not been obliterated altogether.
And it seemed like almost every one of the founding fathers said that if you do take a sledgehammer to those pillars and you take them down, the whole house comes crumbling down as well. And so the Europeans probably were right that eventually this experiment would end in ruin. If the people had kept religion and morality as a part of their everyday lives, that could very well be different, at least as far as obeying God, as far as people understand how. But we don't even have that anymore. It's not even a consideration anymore. And like we always talk about, God bless America is something that is just said. It doesn't mean anything. It's a platitude. It's an empty saying. We don't believe that God is in charge of the country or that he should have any say in political policies or things like that.
Yeah, for sure. It's not even a consideration today. George Washington, it says, America's first president championed this cause. By the way, George Washington's plaque was taken off of a church named after him.
Yeah.
Or they're going to take it off there. So I guess they're going to have to change the name of the church. I mean, it's outrageous. Anyway, that happened over the weekend. That was
in the name of unity. All these things are in the name of unity. The anthem kneeling, the Houston Texans said that was in the name of unity. And yet it never is. I mean, I don't know what world people are living in to say things like that are unifying when they're the center of national arguments. I mean, tearing down the foundations of the country is always going to be controversial. You can't describe that as unified if you're living in reality.
Yeah, and then what do you have left? You know, if your nation isn't founded on something, in this case, religion and morality, you can't look to the physical leaders of the past and have some sort of respect for what they did. You can't even agree to stand up and give honor to the flag of the nation. What do you have? What is that grouping of people? It's just, it's chaos and anarchy like Europe said it would be years and years ago.
Yeah, it's just all types of different factions. It's identity politics to the extreme. I saw an interview months ago with Tucker Carlson on Fox News, and he was talking to this black Muslim woman, and he asked, well, aren't we all Americans? And she's like, well, no, I'm black and Muslim first. And so when you have people like that thinking, well, I care more about my race and this little sect that I'm a part of, or I care more about being Hispanic or speaking a different language inside of America or any of these different things, if we all think that we are little groups inside of one great nation, that doesn't last for very long. You have to consider yourself an American. You can't just think that you're black and Muslim and that matters more somehow.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of the U.S. being a melting pot, if you've ever melted something in a pot, you know that it all comes together as
it becomes
one
the same thing.
Sort of
exactly.
Thing. It's you put some cheese in a pot, melt it. It'll all blend together. It kind of melts together, but now we see all this division. But years ago, a little over 200 years ago, George Washington, America's first president, championed the cause of religion and morality, that high morals and sincere religion had to be the fundamental building blocks of American society if it was to succeed and prosper. In his first inaugural address on April 30th, 1789, he said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." And then it says, "What we do in the privacy of our own home does matter." For Washington, this was not a peripheral issue. It was the foundation of our national policy. Are you going to get many people subscribing to that today?
No.
I don't think so. The common thought today as well, it sets that whole sort of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas mentality, except everybody's got their own little private Vegas at home, to where it doesn't matter what you do. It's your business. And that's the thinking in a lot of cases.
And that remains true on both sides of the political spectrum as well. For a long time, conservatives did try to uphold the values like traditional marriage and family, and obviously trying to prevent the widespread acceptance of homosexuality and transgenderism. But even now, a large part of the voting blocks, even among conservatives, are those different groups that have basically thrown morality into the wind, and they don't care too much about how people's private lives are run. You mentioned as well the melting pot. That I thought that was a really fascinating point too, because if you notice, people don't say that anymore, do they? They say we're a nation of immigrants, but they don't say that these immigrants go into the melting pot, because that would mean that people become the same, that they blend into a common culture and identity. That's not happening. The morality is not there anymore. No one is making a stand on the important things that built the nation. That's what it comes down to. God was the foundation of the nation. Now people are tearing that apart, and we just have so many divided factions warring against themselves now.
Yeah, and if you think about a melting pot on a physical level, once things are kind of melted in there, how do you take them apart? You can't separate the ingredients. Mm-mm. You can't, take out the cheddar and take out the Swiss and say, okay, you go back and you be your own separate cheeses.
Right.
I just think of cheese when I think of a melting pot. But
me too, actually.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way to do it. It just would destroy everything, and that's what we're seeing happening in the U.S., where, like you say, it's becoming very factional, and everyone's trying to have their identity politics, and that does not breed unity or make unity in any way. It just makes division. We're seeing more and more of that. Even this booklet talks about some of the founding fathers. That's even tough to talk about today on a national platform, because people are mad at the founding fathers, or they don't agree with them, or they're angry at them, or they think bad things of them. So we can't even agree on who to look to or who to talk to about the foundation of the nation.
Exactly. There's that argument that the third verse of the national anthem is racist. And so if we're singing it, or we're standing for it, or we're putting our hands over our heart during it, we're actually complicit in condoning racism. So there's even that, where there's so many different arguments like that, that if they were truly picked apart and analyzed, they would be exposed as insane and otherworldly.
Pretty crazy. It's been going that way for quite some time. The Constitution, when you look at it, was established only for a people with strong morals, as this book, Character in Crisis, points out. But we have degenerated terribly in this area. And again, this was written, it's been a while, more than 10 years ago, yeah. I believe. And so, look where we've come. Without character, it says, our liberties will lead to deep division and anarchy. If you want to look at, go to thetrumpet.com, or you want to look at things that have been written years ago, I mean, take a look at when this booklet was written. It's over a decade ago. And just listen to that. We have degenerated terribly in this area, it says. Without character, our liberties will lead to deep division and anarchy. Our character can stop that natural only character, it says, can stop that natural flow of events. Take the time from that was written till today. Has that happened? Of course it has. It's blown up. And that was being written, it was written years and years ago, by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, and look how much more division and anarchy we have today. It's in the headlines today, literally today.
Yeah, it's all very simple. I mean, if God is not in charge, then the only authority left is either Satan or just man himself. That's really where we have turned, is just relying on our own human reasoning to make massive nation-changing decisions. I mean, legalizing homosexual marriage. If God is not in charge, and if God did not establish marriage, for example, then anyone is allowed to come along and say that we can expand the definition of marriage. If there's not a higher authority making these moral codes and expecting us to abide by them, then we can change any of them, and we can either discard God's moral code, or we can just completely alter it so that it doesn't even resemble what it once was.
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's really the kind of the central point, I think, of this booklet, and it's made right here, just like you said. What makes our forefathers' statements so weighty is that they agree with God. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, because, of course, the critic will say, well, I don't agree with what the forefathers said. Okay, well, that's fine, unless the forefathers got their information from God. Now, they didn't know everything, obviously, perfectly, or do everything perfectly, but they looked at the Bible from what they understood of it, and they tried to frame the Constitution on that, on the law of God. And so that's what makes the forefathers' statements so weighty, have so much value. That's what is being destroyed if you destroy what the forefathers tried to establish in the Constitution with the United States. They talk about, well, change the Constitution. Well, maybe in a, you know, there might be a trivial point here or there or something, but if you try to change the foundation of it, you're getting away from God's word, and then you end up with anarchy and chaos, because that's the authority of it. It's the fact that they took it from the Bible.
Exactly right, and there's so many parts of that Constitution that they really should be glorified in society today instead of being vilified like they are. For example, it was written in such a way that slavery could eventually be abolished. I mean, the fact that all men have those inalienable rights endowed to them by God, that means no man can stand in the way. If God gave us these rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then no one can stop those rights from being applied to all human beings. That's why we were able to go to war over that. Abraham Lincoln believed what was in the Constitution, and he saw easy legal grounds even for going into the Civil War. And so to act like the only thing that matters is that they held slaves, some of them, a few of the founding fathers held slaves at the time that they wrote that document, that's just a dishonest way of looking at it, because they even knew it was wrong. And they knew that eventually it would have to be abolished from the country.
Yeah, it's an argument that is set forward to try to destroy everything that was written and everything that the nation was founded on. But it's very misled.
And also, I've even been watching some documentaries and things recently that have just exposed the fact that no other nation in the world truly has free speech. There are nations. And even ones that we think are democratic and Western and you know, tolerant, that have laws against hate speech. Hate speech basically could be defined as anything that someone else doesn't like to hear. And if this subjective measure can apply to one group for talking religiously, it can also apply to another group for maybe being atheist. It doesn't even matter. You could literally be put in prison for saying certain things that offend anybody. And that is the case in every single nation in the world except for America, because we have the right to free speech in this country.
Yeah, and those freedoms are wonderful if they're guided by those two pillars of religion and morality. When we get away from it, then those freedoms actually end up destroying us because we can't control them. That was pointed out by Alex de Tocqueville, who said that while the he observed the U.S. in some of its beginning there and how it was going with this new form of government, I guess. And he said that while the constitutional law of liberty allowed Americans complete freedom to do as they pleased, religion prevented them from doing that which was immoral and unjust. In short, de Tocqueville surmised liberty could not be governed apart from religious faith, lest there be anarchy. So what you've seen happen, what we've all seen happen, we live in this and experience it, is religion, morality has been destroyed. And so now you're left with a lot of freedoms, and it's turning into anarchy. Whereas it was in the time of Judges, everybody does that's right in their own eyes. One group says, keep the statue. Another group says, get rid of the statue. So they meet there at the statue and attack each other. And then we've seen that happen. And that's, is it going to last? Is it going to work this way without religion and morality? We know it's not.
Yeah, and religion at the foundation of this country was the only thing that restrained us from fulfilling our basest lusts and desires. I mean, we see what human nature is capable of. I mean, mass murder, abortion, all types of horrible acts out there that are even, in a lot of cases, glorified in our entertainment now. But those are the types of things that if we had some sort of a religious belief or background or you know, even just obeying God as far as we know how, that would restrain us from committing some of these horrible injustices upon our fellow man.
Yeah, the booklet points out here, again, this is Character in a Crisis, and it's free at thetrumpet.com, and it's great to read because it's written a few years back. You can see how much further we've come down this trail. It says, without the moral restrictions of a higher spiritual law, the liberty afforded Americans the Constitution would be abused. George Washington knew that, so did the rest of the Founding Fathers. That's why they kept harping on religion and morality. They did not want to see the United States of America self-destruct. But that's what happened. Self-destruction occurs because without a higher spiritual law guiding everything, we use our freedoms to destroy ourselves, whether it's freedom of speech, freedom of whatever. We've seen those things be abused over and over again, where because there's no religious law to go back to that people are looking at, any moral code, anything goes in the name of freedom. You can't restrict freedom, so anything goes. But what happens is one person's freedom is another person's slavery, isn't it? You enslave somebody else with your freedoms. It happens.
Yeah, that's true. That's the point that maybe we overlook sometimes. Sure, we have a lot of freedoms today, but how do they affect other people? I mean, we have freedom of speech, but sometimes that allows some of the most vile acts or speech imaginable. For example, what we're seeing during the national anthem. In other countries, would you not be immediately imprisoned for something like that, if not more? So that there does have to be some sort of moral principle guiding our lives, or else you see things like that happening where people are free to completely undermine the country that has given them so many blessings. And you even wonder if that should be tolerated. It is tolerated under free speech, but should people be allowing themselves to stoop to that level?
Well, it is interesting because there's a lot of outcry in the U.S. about oppression. You know, different people are being oppressed or groups are being oppressed in their minds. And it would be really interesting for people to just kind of get some, you know, take a study of some history, see what happens in other nations, and then compare it to what happens in the United States. I was telling you earlier, I saw a little bit of a documentary yesterday about Russia and domestic abuse in Russia. Now, it's a big topic here in the United States. Even within the NFL, there's suspensions and things that happen when people get involved in domestic abuse. Domestic abuse in Russia is barely punished. Barely. And it's allowed to go on. Try living in Russia and seeing how those freedoms are for a while.
That was interesting when you were telling me about that. And it does just show that maybe a lot of us in this country are closed-minded and we don't understand what it's like in other countries. If we're going to complain so much about the problems here, we should be able to pick one country in the world that does any of these things better, and there just isn't one. I mean, for us to be complaining about police brutality or any of these things that are not backed up by cold, hard statistics, the rest of the world must just be scorning us for that. They must be so sick of us in all of our whatever white privilege or any other colored privilege, our American privilege, talking about how we're oppressed when literally people are starving to death, being killed by their own leaders. We don't have any problems nearly the magnitude of things like that.
Yeah, I mean, what in the United States would say, you know, there shouldn't be any abuse, there shouldn't be a domestic abuse or anything like that? Well, it gets back to religion and morality, because there's a higher law of God that, you know, you shouldn't treat anybody that way. You should love your neighbor as yourself and love God more than yourself. And that covers all that. But if you get away from that law, then you're kind of left to the rule of man. Now, maybe for a while that goes in your favor, but then eventually you end up with a nation like a Russia where they don't care. They just don't care about those things. The example they gave in the case of the domestic abuse was a woman, they had a recording of it, a woman called and asked for help because she needed it. And the lady at the police station that took the call, it was a lady, she said, okay, well, if you get killed, we'll come pick up the body. And she laughed at her. And 45 minutes later, the woman was dead.
Man.
And that's not that uncommon of an occurrence. That's today in Russia. So we sit here and complain in the U.S. and all this, but look, why is it like that in Russia? It's because they don't base their nation on religion or morality. They just base it on the rule of a czar. And so when we get away from religion and morality, it ends up in chaos, and then eventually a strong man comes in and rules with an iron fist.
Yeah, it's pretty different over there from what we have here. There are breaches of justice in America. Things like that do happen where someone is able to abuse somebody else. But the difference is when that happens, if a woman were calling the police would be rushing to the aid of that woman, and they would be trying to stop the injustice from taking place. Then after, if they were too late and she were killed, the person would be going to trial. They would be analyzing all the evidence, and they would be trying to put him in prison for however long it should be, or even giving him the death penalty. There is law here. As far as we have fallen morally, there is law. And if a police officer ever exerts unnecessary force and the cold, hard facts prove that, that police officer is punished accordingly. That's how it is here. It's not subjective. It's not based on people's opinions. There is a law in place, and if it is obeyed, then people are punished the way they should be. And there is no person falling through the cracks like that where it's known about, and yet it still happens.
Yeah, so it's not a good picture of what a nation becomes when you get away from religion and morality. Check out this book, Character in Crisis. It's at thetrumpet.com. Very interesting, especially when you see how far we've come since it was written, and not in a good way. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Key David also coming up here in a bit. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, have a great rest of your day. Talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.